Our text this morning will be in Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians chapter 4, if you'd make your way there this morning, if you have a Bible with you. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me. The origins of this little children's taunt are a bit unclear, but whoever said it failed to understand the power of words. Broken bones, while painful, will heal. But the soul does not heal so easily. Disparaging words have a way of becoming lodged in the deepest recesses of our heart. I've watched people leave the church over just a few inflammatory remarks. I've counseled with people who are tormented by just a few harsh words that were spoken to them in their childhood. Things like, you'll never amount to anything. Like a broken record playing in their head, they just can't seem to forget those words. James commented that the tongue is like a small rudder that is able to turn a huge ship. It's like a tiny spark that is able to set in motion a great fire. Importance of our words. I ask you this morning to think about how you would characterize your speech patterns. As Christians, we know that our speech is to be distinct. Matter of fact, Paul writes about it here, of course, but he wrote about it in 1 Timothy chapter 4 as well. A familiar passage, don't let anyone look down on you. He's writing to Timothy, this young protege, this young apprentice, and he says, don't let anyone look down on you because you're young, but set an example in speech, among other things. Speech was to be different, distinctive. And of course, here, in this context, Paul has already talked about the real goal for the believer. It was in chapter 4, verse 24. There in those preceding verses, Paul had talked about the trajectory of the believer, the new identity of the believer, that God had brought them out of sort of this self-focused, destructive pattern of living and had brought them over into a new realm. He'd caused the old to be put off and the new to be put on, and they were being renewed in the likeness of God, in true righteousness and holiness. If you think about this in light of the biblical story, that's how it started. Genesis 1, God created Adam and Eve. He created them in His image to reflect His glory and His beauty in the world, to reflect His righteousness in the world, and to rule over the rest of creation. And of course, that was distorted by sin. That image, we reflect it still, but we reflect it poorly because of sin. But in Christ now, God has begun to do something new, to recreate us once again in the image of God. And part of that has to do with our speech. We're to reflect God in the use of our words. What would it look like to reflect God in your speech patterns? That's the question we want to ask and hopefully answer this morning from this text. Follow along as I read Ephesians 4:29. Hear the word of the Lord. Let no corrupting talk come out of your mouths, but only such as is good for building up as fits the occasion, that it may give grace to those who hear. And do not grieve the Holy Spirit of God, by whom you were sealed for the day of redemption. May the Lord add His blessing to the reading of His word. How do you reflect God in your speech patterns? Well, Paul's been dealing with a number of different sins. We've been considering them week by week. And in each case, there's a familiar pattern. He gives us a behavior to avoid. He gives us a behavior to adopt. And then he gives us a motivation or a rationale of why this is so important. And this is no exception. So those three things will constitute our very simple outline this morning. A behavior to avoid, a behavior to adopt, and a motivation we need to latch on to. So first, filter your speech to remove anything that is unprofitable. Filter your speech to remove anything that is unprofitable. Should not allow any corrupting talk to come out of our mouths. This idea of corrupt is referring to something that has no good or redeeming purpose. We have two very vivid examples in Scripture of where this word was used, and I think it helps us kind of stretch our imaginations to think of what it would look like to have corrupting speech. Okay, the first is Matthew 7, verse 17, and the context has to do with fruit and fruit trees. So every healthy tree bears good fruit, but the diseased tree bears bad fruit. A healthy tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor can a diseased tree bear good fruit. So interesting, we would tend to think of, you know, that's the fruit itself that is corrupt or rotten, right? No good. Here it's actually technically talking about the tree. The tree is somehow, ESV brings it across, I think it's a good translation, diseased. I mean, there's something wrong with the tree. It's not producing usable or profitable fruit. I've got a couple of those trees in my yard right now. You're well versed in the stories of my hobby orchard and the many failures, okay? But that's what it's describing, a tree that doesn't do what it's supposed to do. The fruit isn't usable. It has to just be discarded. The second example or imagery is in Matthew 13, and it has to do with fishing. So here we read, when it, meaning the net, they were fishing with nets, okay? When it was full, when the net was full, men drew it ashore and sat down and sorted the good into containers, but threw away the bad. There's our word, okay? We're used to fishing. Joe Pruitt's here. He's our resident fisherman. You know, he casts his his line into the water and has a fairly certain likelihood of what he's going to catch. I mean, based on the lure, the bait that he's using and that sort of thing. And probably it's going to be alive unless he just happens to snag something dead. But of course, when you're fishing with a net like these disciples would have been in the Sea of Galilee, and you're casting a big net into the water and then you're pulling that up, you're likely to come up with all sorts of things in that net, right? You might come up with some driftwood or a lot of seaweed or whatever. And here, they're referencing the fact that there were some good, you know, they would take the good fish and they would set them aside and they would take the bad ones and discard them. So either you might get a dead fish in that haul, right? Or I suppose you might get what my dad used to call junk fish. You might get like, my dad used to talk about the carp, you know, these bottom feeder fish that really aren't good to eat. And maybe in some cases it's a bit of an invasive species, you know. So if you ever got one of those, then you're just throwing it off into the weeds. You don't want that back in the lake. And so you have this type of thing. These are useless fish. They can't be sold at the market either because they're rotten or they're just the wrong kind of fish. So we have these images in our minds of fruit that just isn't usable, fish that are not usable, and speech that is not usable, it's not profitable, it's no good. Now, this would certainly include some pretty overt things like what we would call foul language or profanity or sexual innuendo, those types of things. It would also include demeaning speech, some forms of sarcasm that just have no profit other than perhaps some rush that you get out of belittling someone else. Joking, certain forms of joking. I'm sometimes concerned about political. I'm often concerned about political joking. We are called to honor those who are in leadership over us. Whether we agree with their policies or not, that's a pretty specific command by the Lord. And so I'm concerned sometimes when people engage in political jokes that tend to sort of demean a candidate or someone who's serving in leadership. Certainly would include slanderous speech, speech that's intent on destroying another person's reputation. So we have all those really overt things, but I would suggest beyond that, that there's other forms of useless speech. Paul was critical of speech that was just simply not profitable. Matter of fact, in 1 Corinthians 14, he talks about speaking in tongues and spiritual gifts and different things. And he says, I would prefer that someone would speak in a known language so that everyone could profit, so that everyone could benefit. If someone speaks in a foreign language, unless there's someone there to interpret it, then there's no benefit for everyone else. Paul just didn't have much time for useless speech. Jesus said the same thing. Matthew chapter 12, he talked about giving account for every idle or careless word that was spoken. So this is not just about rooting out bad things. It's about rooting out anything that is not profitable. And I think in our culture, we are particularly inclined, or sort of there's a particular temptation to engage in a lot of what I'm going to call ephemeral speech. Sort of quick snippets, speech that's sort of fleeting. It's not, doesn't have a lot of significance to it. Things like texting, where we use just sort of really abrupt portions of sentences. We don't use full sentences, you know, tweeting, Facebook posts, all these things where we have these mediums. You know, it used to be that I would, you know, maybe be meeting with someone and I'd be thinking about for a few days, you know, oh, I'm going to talk to them about, and I shouldn't say that. No, that would not be good. You know, and just time sort of causes me to sort of pause a little bit and refine what I should say and what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. And now the thought comes into my mind and it's out there, you know, in cyberspace, and I can't get it back, you know. And sometimes we're just very rash with our words, and we don't allow that opportunity to just think through and be thoughtful about our speech. I think we need to do some cleaning out in our life in this regard. My wife is a thrower. One of the things I love about her, if we don't have a use for it, it's out of here. And that makes our house a great place to live in, because we're not tripping over stuff. The tables are not cluttered with all sorts of things. It's gone. You know, either we're using it or it's gone. And I really like that in her. You know, some of you are more savers than throwers, and I understand that dilemma that you're in and that disease that you have. But I think we could all agree at some level that, you know, I mean, if there's a car, a broken down car in the middle of your driveway, it's only got one wheel on it, this is a problem, right? I mean, it's not serving any good use. It's not necessarily evil. It's just in the way. You're constantly having to work around it. It's preventing you from doing other things with your driveway, right? So at a very base level, we'd say, well, these are things that just, I need to get rid of them, not necessarily because they're evil, but just because they're not doing anything of any value. And I need to replace those words with productive words. So how do we filter our speech? The tongue is exceedingly difficult to control. James talks about this in his letter. King David recognized his own need for God's help. He felt very incapable of sort of getting a hold of this area of his life, of his speech. We see this in Psalm 41. The reality is that God has given us His Spirit to help us. One of the fruits of the Spirit, we read in Galatians 5, is self-control. I'm able to control my speech, not because I'm so great, but because God has given me His Spirit to help me with that. So we need to pray. We need to ask God to help us. Maybe this needs to be a very pointed request for your prayer life, that you ask God to help you with your speech. There's certainly other techniques and things we can implement. I think one of the practical applications here is that if we really get a hold of this, we will talk less. I'm not trying to be sarcastic here, but just I think that's just a reality. If we really get a handle on this and I'm only going to use profitable speech, then there's going to be a lot of things that I just think in my mind, yeah, no, I'll just keep my mouth shut, right? We might, you know, make a choice to not respond with an email right away, particularly if we're emotional. First of all, if it's a confrontation issue, you shouldn't be using email anyways, all right? All right? Clear on that? That's an inappropriate use of the communication medium. But sometimes you're just emotional about something, and it'd be better to kind of draft that and put it in your drafts before you send it out. You know, give it some time to sort of percolate. Maybe you develop a discipline that before I say anything, I'm going to pause for just a second or two and say it in my mind before I say it with my lips and make sure it's what I really should be saying. I remember going to some of the parent meetings when Anna was playing volleyball in junior high and her freshman year. It became very evident the tenor of the meeting. I mean, like 80% of the meeting was about parents. You know, like there was a lot of behavior problems with parents. It was very clear. And they're trying to head this off, you know. So they're like, okay, if you have problems with your daughter's playing time, here's what you do. Have your daughter go and talk to the coach. If you still have a problem, then you go and talk to the coach. Don't come to me as the athletic director. Go and talk to the coach. And they said, and we will not entertain any discussion after a game. 24 hours. If it's still bothering you 24 hours later, then you come in and talk with us. This is a secular institution. But there's just some wisdom in that, in having to put some delays in your speech. Could also do a lot to create a culture where this type of speech is just not tolerated, particularly overtly negative speech. Augustine in the 5th century had a motto on the wall of his dining room. It said, "He who speaks evil of an absent man or woman is not welcome at this table." That's pretty good. Just put out the vibes right away that that's not where I'm going and we're not going to tolerate that. And we could do a lot, I think, to create a culture where we value people and we value profitable speech. Well, secondly, not only do we need to filter your speech, but we need to only allow speech that is beneficial to the other person. We need to cultivate speech that benefits the other person. So with the behavior to avoid, no corrupting talk, filter your speech. The positive command is to embrace and cultivate only constructive, beneficial speech. We must speak with the other person's good in mind. And the text helps us to think through what that would look like and how we should process that. First of all, it must be constructive. This is actually the word here, which is a building, a construction term. In verse 29, only such as is good for building up. And this was really Paul's gold standard for speech. I referenced already 1 Corinthians 14, but in this text, and I think I give you one verse here in your outline, but actually this appears, this concept, this principle appears like 6 or 7 times in the one chapter. I mean, Paul just kept hammering it. This is the rule you have to address when you think about your speech. So he says, "What then, brothers, when you come together, each one has a hymn, a lesson, a revelation, a tongue, or an interpretation. Here it is. Let all things be done for building up." That's the question you have to ask. How will this person benefit from these words? Proverbs relays the same principle. There is one whose rash words are like sword thrusts, but the tongue of the wise brings healing. So there's some who leave a wake of destruction in their path. Broken relationships, hurt feelings. But the wise person leaves healing in their path. They leave people more strengthened in their faith than they were previously. So it must be constructive. You have to ask that question. How will this person benefit from these words? It must be appropriate. It's an interesting phrase here. ESV says, no corrupting talk, but only such as is good for building up as fits the occasion. The phrase here actually is a word that describes deficit or a lack. And it was used actually back in verse 28, the preceding verse. Paul just used this term. There he said, you should work with your hands to provide for your own needs, but also to be able to have some to help others. To help those who are in need. There's the word. Who are in want. Who have a deficit. You can help with your surplus. And here he says, in the emotional realm or the spiritual realm, people have deficits. They have blind spots. They have shortcomings. They have areas of weakness. They've got some things in their minds that they've been rehearsing that are just not true. And they need help. They need someone to speak truth into their life. So I need to ask myself the question, what does this person need? Sometimes we're just too busy talking about ourselves to really key in on what that person needs. Okay? But that should be a question we're asking. This person maybe just has some really annoying patterns. But I start to think, why do they act that way? What is the insecurity there that feeds that? What is the aspect of brokenness in their life? And what could I do to help them? Okay, so we need to be asking that question. And of course, it must be gracious. It must be constructive, must be appropriate, must be gracious. Literally, our speech should give grace to those who hear. We could understand this a couple of different ways, this term grace. What would it look like to give grace? I mean, at the beginning part of this letter, Paul uses grace to describe unmerited favor, right? God's great, extravagant grace. God had given forgiveness of sins. But later in the letter here, Paul uses grace to describe enablement. Notice back in chapter 3, verse 1, for this reason I, Paul, a prisoner for Christ Jesus, on behalf of you Gentiles, assuming that you have heard of the stewardship of God's grace that was given to me for you. In other words, God had called me to a ministry to take the gospel to the Gentiles, to the non-Jewish people, and God has given me an allotment of grace for that purpose, to help me so that I can carry out this task. And he uses the same terminology to describe the believers in chapter 4, verse 7. But grace was given to each one of us. Grace was not just given to Paul, but God also gave grace or enablement to all of us so that we could have a role of building up the church. So in a sense, this is what we are to do. People have a deficit. They have a want, a need. We all do. And God has given us grace, and we are to convey that grace to others, to help others along the way, like God has helped us. So our speech must be gracious. This survival story of World War II veteran Louis Zamperini is told in his book, in the book, Unbroken. It's not a read for the faint of heart, although it is a very good read. He describes his time, among other things, in an unregistered Japanese POW camp. The key word there is unregistered. the normal POW camps, the registered ones, there were certain common expectations of how prisoners were to be treated. This was an unregistered camp, and the conditions were deplorable. They were given scanty portions of rancid food to eat. Many of the men had lost half their body weight, were sick with beriberi and other symptoms of malnutrition, severe malnutrition. But one of the greatest hardships was that they were not allowed to speak. Matter of fact, you were never to look a Japanese guard or officer in the eyes. You would have your eyes down at all times. So they're shuffling about doing their work. And he talked about how they found creative ways to communicate with one another. When the guards would leave the barracks for a few moments in the evening, they would begin tapping in Morse code to the neighboring barracks, and they would communicate with one another. And he said most of it was pretty trivial. There wasn't anything, you know, deep that was being communicated, but the very act of speaking to one another reminded us that we were human. The power of words or taps, however you want to think about it. Words have a powerful capacity to carry us. I remember coming back from a soccer game my senior year of high school, and I was the first one back to the bus, and my coach, Jim Kester, happened to be a strong believer. It was just he and I, and I remember very distinctly, he was sitting in the seat of the bus, had opened it up so people could start coming on, and nobody else was coming, and I stood there in the doorway of the bus, and he said to me, "Jeff, have you ever considered that God might be calling you into vocational ministry?" It's a very brief conversation, but it's emblazoned in my mind. Those words tumbled around for the next 4 or 5 years as I'm trying to figure out what to do with my life, what God wanted me to do with my life. The power of words. Shouldn't just settle for like rooting out bad things, but we need to be committed to using our words for great benefit, of speaking truth into the lives of people, taking an interest, understanding their needs, and speaking appropriately. Well, finally, we ought to consider the impact of worthless speech. So we have a behavior to avoid, no corrupt talk. We have a behavior to adopt, speech that is beneficial, serves to build up. And then we have this motivation. Consider the impact of worthless speech. And here's what Paul says in summary. It is not just that the church is weakened when we fail to speak constructive words to one another, but when we fail to contribute to the unity of the church, we put ourselves at odds with God. Specifically, His Spirit, who dwells in us. We see here that the Spirit is capable of being grieved. Do not grieve, into verse 30, do not grieve the Spirit of God. The Spirit is not a nebulous force, but is rather a person who is able to experience deep emotion. King David was grieved when his son Absalom was killed. And Absalom was a creep. I mean, he was a traitor. He turned against David. But when it came right down to it, he was still his son. And he was deeply moved when he received word. This is the emotion of the Spirit, that he is grieved by sins of speech. And the Spirit indwells every believer. He says, "Do not grieve the Spirit of God, by whom you," or "you all," "were sealed." That the Spirit is present in each of us. The Spirit dwells in me, and if you know Christ, the Spirit dwells in you. And when you or I fight or act selfishly, it grieves the Spirit. And the Spirit has sealed our salvation. It denotes both ownership and protection. A seal, like a brand on cattle, identifies that with the owner. And in a certain royal sense, it also conveys authorization or protection. A person might be given an escort under the safety, under the seal of the king. And all these things are brought about by the Spirit's work in our lives. We are marked as God's children with all the corresponding benefits and privileges and protections. So many blessings. Rachel Canning may or may not be a familiar name to you. She is the 18-year-old from New Jersey who recently sued her parents for financial support. Have you heard the story? Just this last week. Rachel left home of her own accord after chafing at her parents' requests that she follow basic house rules, including doing some chores, abiding by curfew, and being respectful. The family had also quarreled over Rachel's boyfriend, whom the Cannings called a bad influence. Rachel wanted her parents to continue to pay her living expenses, even though she refused to follow their guidelines. So she moved out, and now she wants mom and dad to cover her costs. and she took it to court. Rachel received a wake-up call when the court sided against her. She found out that this is not how life works. Judge Bogard responded to the ludicrous nature of the lawsuit in saying, "Are we going to open the gates for 12-year-olds to sue for an Xbox? For 13-year-olds to sue for an iPhone?" Stories like that kind of make my blood boil a little bit, right? Spoiled girl needs to be reminded of what she has, and yet I find myself wondering if we're sometimes not that much different than Rachel Canning. Sometimes we want all the benefits that come with being a part of God's family, but we have no interest in living according to the family rules. And Paul says here, by way of motivation, after all that God has done for you, you're going to grieve His Spirit and actively work against what He is seeking to accomplish in the world for His glory and for His name? Really? After you've been sealed right up to the day of redemption, you've been purchased, blessed, provided for, and now you're not going to do what God is asking you to do as your loving Heavenly Father? What a tremendous motivation for us to adopt His speech pattern. So what is it this morning that you need to do to conform to the image of God in this whole arena of words? Perhaps you need to remove all that unprofitable speech. Perhaps it's overt. Perhaps maybe particularly in the workplace or in a given setting, you find your language beginning to sort of conform to those you're working with. Maybe it's a pattern of gossip or some slanderous type of tendency that you have to just lash out against other people. Maybe it's more subtle, just unprofitable speech. Just not giving careful thought before you post or before you text or before you respond. Maybe not bad things, but do your words have meaning? Are they rich? Are they well thought through? Are they seasoned with grace? Perhaps you need to commit yourself to speech that benefits others. Perhaps you need to begin to ask the question as you prepare to sit down for dinner with your family, or you prepare to go to work, or you prepare to come to church, and you ask yourself the question, what are the needs that are represented in our church family? I know I'm going to see this person. I know I'm going to see this person. I know my child is going to be home from school soon. What do they need? What's going on in their heart? What can I do to speak God's words into their life? God has extended grace to me to help me, and now He's asked me to extend grace and help to those in my circle. What I need to do to perhaps think more carefully and proactively about how to use my speech for the benefit of others. And perhaps you need to just be reminded in this third area of motivation, just need to be reminded of the impact of your speech on your relationship with God. I think sometimes we look at this and think, yeah, well, at least it's not one of the big sins, right? Useless, unprofitable speech grieves the Spirit of God. That's a pretty big exclamation point. To not use my speech for God is to act at odds with Him, to stand in the way of what He's accomplishing. It's pretty serious. Perhaps we need to just revisit again all that God has done for us and bringing us into His family, sealing us, identifying us, protecting us, blessing us. And to have to think, really? After all He's done for me, and I'm going to hang on to this little speech thing? I'm not going to give myself to speaking His words. Perhaps it's that arena of motivation that you just need to sort of do some business with God this morning as well.